Welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, March 12, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Looking at the front page of the Globe-Gazette for today, there are really only two stories. One is kind of a sidebar, Southbridge Mall clears to close at end of month, and the big story, the big headline is Drawn Out Redistricting Report Card, and it shows a map of the United States, and the state of Iowa is colored yellow, which is graded better than average with some bias. And then surrounding us, just for fun, Minnesota is green, which is good, also is South Dakota and Missouri. And then Nebraska is also yellow, which is better than average with some bias. And then red is poor, and that is Kansas, Illinois, Wisconsin around us. And the copy reads, Wonky maps minimize voters' sway balance of power in U.S. elections. This is from Lee.net. Mika Gadsden is well-versed in the electoral process, having run for mayor, served as a polling precinct clerk, and worked as a political activist over the past decade. But Gadsden said even she was having a hard time determining which congressional district she is slated to vote in later this year in South Carolina's Charleston County. Her confusion stems from a process known as gerrymandering, in which political parties in power manipulate the boundaries of voting districts to gain an electoral upper hand. The process can amount to an assault on democracy, Gadsden said. The effects of gerrymandering are neither new nor uncommon, but with Democrats and Republicans currently splitting control of Congress by the narrowest of margins, experts say the number of pending redistricting battles and newly released maps could help determine which party holds the levers of power in the U.S. House of Representatives after this year's elections. The states where the stakes are highest include, and then there's a bulleted list, South Carolina, where the U.S. Supreme Court is expected to decide soon whether to allow a new congressional map to stand. New York, where the state legislature rejected this week the latest congressional maps drawn by a bipartisan commission. Louisiana, where a new map released in late January creates an additional majority black congressional district. North Carolina, where redistricting has been the subject of Supreme Court rulings and ongoing lower court fights. South Carolina's electoral maps, redrawn in 2021, moved Gadsden and some 30,000 other black voters out of a competitive district and into one that has been in Democratic hands for four decades. The process, she said, has sown seeds of confusion and really does demoralize a lot of people who find their vote will carry less weight. What we see is that the powers that be have pretty much picked the winners for people, Gadsden said. It's so undemocratic. It's really an assault on democracy in general. The practice of moving electoral district boundaries to promote certain outcomes, such as increasing the odds that a certain party wins or reducing the voting power of particular groups of voters, is not a new part of our election system. Politicians have employed the tactic for centuries. Voting rights activists have been trying to combat it for about as long. The back and forth has left courts to determine when such redistricting crosses a legal line. After South Carolina's governor signed the new maps into law, the state NAACP and a local voter sued, alleging that the new state map is an example of illegal gerrymandering that discriminates against those voters based on the color of their skin. With that case now in the hands of the Supreme Court, the implications for Gadsden and other voters in Charleston could be significant. Should the court decide the gerrymander was illegal, those black voters will go back to casting their ballots for a seat that a Democrat held as recently as 2021, when Republican Representative Nancy Mace won election. And with Republicans holding razor-thin majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, experts say the ramifications of that court decision and a handful of other pending cases that allege illegal gerrymanders could be felt nationwide. Quote, "There are going to be some places where Democrats pick up a seat or two, or maybe in New York, three or four," said Paul M. Smith, senior vice president of the nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center, and a lawyer who has argued multiple landmark gerrymandering cases before the Supreme Court. Quote, "In North Carolina, when the new Supreme Court there had the map redrawn, the Democrats lost two or three or four seats. So it may end up having a net effect that's fairly modest across the country," Smith said. "But given how closely divided the House is, we might very well find that a decision or two here were decisive, because whichever party is in control next time might be in control of the House by about two seats." Mitchell D. Brown, senior counsel for voting rights for the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, puts the problem of gerrymandering plainly. "It occurs," he said, "when legislators are, quote, choosing their voters and voters are not choosing their legislators. Our democracy is supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people," Brown said. "But right now, it's of the elected officials, by the elected officials, and for the elected officials." The anti-democratic effects of gerrymandering, Brown and other experts argue, are wide-ranging. When individual voters see the power of their vote weaken as they are packed by party, race, and other factors into districts designed to reliably elect candidates of a certain party, Brown said, it tends to dampen voter interest in elections where outcomes seem preordained. Voters also can be undermined by a gerrymandering tactic known as cracking, which involves splitting up groups of voters and assigning them to electoral districts that are safe for the party they don't belong to. However, gerrymandering is implemented, Brown said. The result is it makes it harder for voters to hold politicians accountable at the ballot box. And when officials are less accountable to their constituents, he said, the effects are felt far beyond the polling precinct. The practical effect is there's less representation, Brown said. When gerrymandering is based on race, he added, the needs of the black community are not met because you have elected officials that don't speak to the experience of the black community. The creation of safe seats can also exacerbate partisan polarization and push people to the extremes politically, said Smith of the Campaign Legal Center, because politicians have to focus primarily on winning primaries, not general elections. And that, Smith said, pushes people toward the extreme right or the extreme left. While the problems with gerrymandering are easy to see, the practice is difficult to stop, according to Smith, who has spent decades trying to do so. Despite repeated attempts to get the Supreme Court to find it illegal when an electoral map, quote, is designed to guarantee one party wins the most seats, even if they don't get most of the votes, unquote, Smith said the court determined in 2019 that such partisan gerrymandering is a political question that's too complicated for the federal courts to deal with. And so, he said, you can't go to federal court and challenge partisan gerrymandering. But the U.S. Supreme Court has affirmed the rights of state courts to combat partisan gerrymandering in maps drawn by state legislatures. Last year, the court ruled that the North Carolina courts can regulate redistricting to ensure that it accords with the state constitution. Quote, North Carolina has really been ground zero for the redistricting and gerrymandering conversations nationwide, said Chris Cooper, a political science professor at Western Carolina University. The Supreme Court ruling leaves the partisan gerrymandering fight at a state level. In North Carolina, that allowed a new conservative state Supreme Court majority to reverse a previous ruling, allowing Republican earning redistricting maps to be implemented for the 2024 election, Cooper said. The court also ruled that political gerrymandering was not a question for state courts. The fight over gerrymandering in North Carolina is nothing new, but has increased in the past decade, Cooper said. Since 2010, the state has seen seven congressional district voting maps enacted, four of which were used in elections. The change in gerrymandering after 2010 was seen in Texas as well, Rice University political science professor Mark Jones said. The state's 2021 voting maps reflected unbridled gerrymandering in a way that hadn't been the case since 2005 and 2011. Congressional districts in Texas pack Democrats together, twisting and turning to form wonky shapes that span miles. In Texas, the redistricting has all but ensured that a Republican hold in the state, Jones said. While gerrymandering might not always play a significant role in elections, in a year like 2024, when the election is close, a handful of seats could affect control. Gerrymandering takes some of the question out of elections, leaving some voters feeling disenfranchised, Jones said. The near-constant changes in North Carolina also make it difficult for voters to know who represents them at a state and national level, Cooper said. Despite challenges, Cooper said, it's unlikely anything will change in North Carolina. The latest maps in North Carolina, allowed by the state Supreme Court, are still being challenged in court, Cooper said. The most recent lawsuit, filed in December, alleges racial gerrymandering, the first case to do so for the current maps, he said. Quote, The stakes are too large for people to not at least try to overturn these maps, Cooper said. Both parties are challenging the maps. It's very clear they know the maps mean power. It's a convenient fiction, but a fiction nonetheless, to say the people still get the final say. While courts have become the main battleground over partisan gerrymandering, the U.S. Supreme Court has found that federal courts can get involved in race-based gerrymandering. That's based in part on the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, which says states cannot undermine citizens' rights, and in part on the Voting Rights Act, a 1965 law, that was designed to ensure all citizens have an equal opportunity to participate in elections. But to pursue cases under those provisions, a court has to first determine whether race was, quote, the predominant motive in the minds of the people drawing the lines, Smith said. And that can be tricky, especially when race seems to be used as a proxy for party, as often occurs with black voters, who tend overwhelmingly to vote for Democrats. Brown said the difficulty in making distinctions between race and party means that black voters don't have the same protections. All the legislature has to do is say, hey, we didn't do this for racial reasons. We did this for partisan reasons, Brown said. Courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have heard several cases that hinge on such determinations. While many of its decisions were widely viewed as undermining legal protections for black voters, the court surprised observers last year when it upheld a key piece of the Voting Rights Act that requires, quote, states to create opportunities for voters of color to elect candidates of their choice when they're faced with massive racially polarized voting, like in the South, Smith said. The effect of that decision will be felt in this year's congressional election, because the ruling resulted in the drawing of a second black majority district in Alabama. That district is expected to elect a Democrat to Congress. It also means that there will be continued efforts to create majority black, majority Latino districts in situations where, if you don't, the majority white population will control all the districts, Smith said. So that was a very positive decision for those who believe in racial justice and districting. To believe that a legislature can draw a race-blind map is farcical, Brown said. These people know where the black voters are, where the white voters are, where the Latino voters are. To say something is race-blind, you can draw your district by memory and you know how to gerrymander. Race is always going to undergird what the legislature does, which is going to affect minority voters. The South Carolina case, currently pending in the U.S. Supreme Court, hinges on whether the justices find politics or race influenced the district maps. If justices rule the new electoral maps were drawn to advance a partisan advantage, the changes will be allowed to stand. If the High Court determines legislators were motivated by a desire to pack black voters in a single safe district, the court could order maps to be withdrawn. And the next story from the front page, Claire's to close at the end of the month. Last corporate-owned store blames development delay. Since Southbridge Mall opened in 1985, plenty of stores have come and gone. This month, the last corporate-owned retail store in the mall had just decided not to renew its lease. Over the weekend, Claire's manager, Sandy Schuponitz, posted a sign on the store window announcing that the retailer will close at the end of the month, citing Southbridge Mall owner David Ritchie's failure to follow through with an extensive renovation of the ailing shopping center. Quote, "With a heavy heart, we regret to inform you our store will be closing at the end of the month," the sign read in part. "Our loyal customers have made us number one in sales measurables, and we continue to be profitable. Due to the failure to follow through with the plans in the mall, we have to say goodbye." Schuponitz says her store is still well in the black. "This isn't a matter of not having customers. I've seen some of the same families come in for years. So many little girls all grown up," she added wistfully. "We're closing because corporate took a look at the real estate map for the mall and found it lacking." Claire's is one of the last remaining businesses at Southbridge. After the accessory and jewelry boutique closes, Larson's Red Zone Sports Memorabilia store will be the last retail storefront. Natural Nails, entertainment locales River City Mini Golf and Country Axe, and restaurants Pad Thai Express and the Sports Page are still in operation. Southbridge Mall was purchased by Raichi and Southbridge Mason City LLC. The development was announced in May 2021. Raichi is also the developer of the Hyatt Place Hotel development, the downtown Mason City Hotel project currently on hold, awaiting closing of the property. Deb Dreger of Country Axe said, "She's grateful axe throwing isn't something you can do online. Our business is good," she said. "Since it was sold, though, our future in the mall has been up in the air. Time and time again, we've seen changes in plans." At an April 2022 Mason City Council meeting, Raichi indicated he would have new businesses opening in the mall by the end of that year. He also said that he would have family entertainment amenities, like a go-kart track, a movie theater, and a bowling alley completed in the mall by the end of the first quarter of 2023. In January 2023, at the State of North Iowa address, Raichi and his business partner Bob Johnson announced the mall development was on track, and they were considering the addition of apartments on top of the Southbridge property. In the intervening months, Mason City has issued an ultimatum to Raichi and his companies. A December 20, 2023 financing deadline was the last step before construction was to begin in 2024. Raichi did not provide financing documents at that time. The city has given him 120 days from the January 12th notification to provide the money needed to begin the project, meaning he has until May 11th to make good on his plans with the mall and hotel projects. City Administrator Aaron Burnett said the city has its hands tied until that date. Quote, "Should he not have financing in place by then, the city will take ownership of the properties." Next story, garage fire extinguished with no injuries. The Mason City Fire Department responded to a garage fire Saturday night on the south side of town, clearing the scene after midnight. Just before 10:30 p.m., March 9th, the fire department was dispatched for the report of a garage fire on 29th Street Southwest in Mason City. Arriving on the scene, fire crews found an unattached garage on fire, with flames present on the garage's south exterior and from the inside. No injuries were reported, and the firefighters were able to extinguish the fire quickly. The fire department reported the cause of the fire is believed to be electrical, stemming from a motorcycle that was getting work done on it earlier in the evening. Emergency crews were able to clear the scene at about 1 a.m., and no outside agencies needed to assist with the fire. Sheriff's Office arrests Clear Lake man after crash. The Cerro Gordo County Sheriff's Office responded to a collision Friday evening that resulted in the arrest of a Clear Lake man. At around 7:43 p.m. March 8, County deputies responded to a two-vehicle accident on 255th Street west of Lark Avenue. Arriving on the scene, deputies initiated an investigation, including witness statements and vehicle evidence. They found that Nathan Barney, age 42, of Clear Lake, was driving a 2006 Buick Lucerne westbound. He had crossed the center line and struck an oncoming vehicle. The vehicle received extensive damage and was disabled in the eastbound lane of traffic. Barney had crossed onto oncoming traffic, striking an eastbound 2010 Ford Edge that also received extensive damage. The driver in the Ford was taken to Mercy One North Iowa by the Mason City Fire Medics with non-life-threatening injuries from the crash. The deputies on scene arrested and charged Barney with OWI, first offense, and driving on the wrong side of the roadway. He was then taken to the Cerro Gordo County Jail. Our next story, Strange Bedfellows, Vape Bill Drawing Unusual Coalition of Foes Together. This is from the Globe Gazette. A bill supported by the tobacco industry would ban vape retailers from selling vape products not listed on a state-approved registry has united two disparate groups in opposition, vape shops and public health advocates. The companion legislation, House Study Bill 682 and Senate Bill 2402, would require retailers, distributors, and wholesalers who sell vapor products in the new state to put them on a new registry. Retailers could sell only products listed on the registry, which would be limited to those the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved for sale. The registration fee is $100 per product. Those that violate the provisions would be subject to a $300 a day penalty. Money collected from fees and penalties would be deposited into a trust fund to be used for substance use disorder treatment and prevention and tobacco prevention cessation and enforcement. At first blush, the bill seems to close a loophole leveraged by e-cigarette manufacturers and distributors. Before manufacturers can sell a new e-cigarette product, they must submit an application to the FDA to market the products. The FDA then can either grant their application, at which point they can sell their products indefinitely, or the FDA can deny their application, at which point they must cease selling them altogether. Because of the lengthy time that it takes the FDA to process applications, or because of legal challenges to denials, manufacturers and distributors keep their products in the marketplace until they receive a final answer. Since 2020, 26 million tobacco products, the vast majority of which are vapor products, have been submitted for FDA approval. To date, the FDA has authorized just 23 e-cigarette products and related devices, all of them tobacco-flavored, while rejecting more than a million applications. And only three brands, all made by tobacco companies, have received FDA marketing authorization. Manufacturers have challenged the denials in court and use a variety of legal maneuvers to delay agency action. Most e-cigarette applications fall into limbo of having received approval or denial to market their product. Without the former, the products cannot legally be sold in the United States. But as a result, thousands of e-cigarette products, including flavored products popular among youth, are being sold in Iowa and across the country without proper FDA authorization. The FDA has not aggressively pursued enforcement actions against manufacturers who either never applied for FDA approval or who did but persist in selling products that have not been authorized. The tobacco industry-backed registry law, which mirrors those passed and being considered in other states, is purportedly intended to fill the enforcement void left by FDA inaction and inability to control the tumultuous vaping market more than 3 years after the agency declared a crackdown on youth-friendly flavors. Most of the unauthorized disposable vapes being sold in the United States, such as Elf Bar, come from China, in sweet and fruity flavors that have made them a favorite nicotine product among teens. Hundreds of new varieties appear each month, the Associated Press reported. The influx has upended the FDA's regulatory model. Instead of carefully reviewing individual products that might help adult smokers, regulators must now somehow claw back thousands of illegal products sold under the radar. Public health advocates say lawmakers should carefully consider the public health implications of the bill and evaluate whose interests it advances. The American Cancer Society is registered as opposed to the bill, as is CAFE, which stands for Clean Air for Everyone. And their name also, it's CAFE, Iowa Citizens Action Network, and they're an organization that advocates for tobacco control policies. The American Heart Association and Iowa Primary Care Association are registered undecided. Opponents argue the bill does nothing to reduce youth consumption and instead benefits tobacco companies. At the end of the day, this bill will do nothing to reduce youth consumption, nor adult use likely, said Teresa Harms, who's a lobbyist for CAFE Iowa Citizens Action Network. We see it as an industry bill that does nothing other than help tobacco companies increase their market share and ultimately their products. If serious about reducing youth vaping, lawmakers could consider advertising bans, taxing vape products the same as tobacco, and requiring a retail permit fee, Harms said. Corey Halfhill, owner of Central Iowa Vapors, which has stores in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, said the bill would eliminate 99% of the vapor products in the market and force him to close his 15 stores, putting 80 workers out of jobs. It would overregulate us to the point where you can't conduct business, Halfhill said. We're not like a convenience store. You take a handful of items out at a convenience store, they're going to be able to still sell gas and be able to continue to sell soda and all the snacks and things. He said the industry is frustrated by FDA inaction and is advocating for fair regulations that allow for vaping products to remain on the market while ensuring customer or consumer safety. He said he regularly meets with manufacturers and visits their facilities, including in China, and requests information and documentation that their products have either been approved, denied, or pending review by the FDA. Halfhill emphasized the importance of addressing youth vaping, but believes the government should focus on holding social media giants accountable for promoting vaping products to minors and work with the industry to promote tobacco harm reduction and support products proven to be safer than tobacco. Halfhill and Sarah Linden, owner of Generation V in Council Bluffs and Davenport, said vape users will find other ways to get their product if it is unavailable in their stores, whether online or just across the border in neighboring states. Quote, if this bill goes into effect, businesses like mine, because we are good actors, we will close, Linden said. But there's going to be stores that don't, and then they're going to be selling whatever illicit products to whatever age group, including potentially teens. Where we screen and only sell to 21 plus, she said. It's a 10-minute drive across the border to Illinois or Nebraska from her shops in Davenport and Council Bluffs, where those states have no intention of passing these bills. David Scott, a lobbyist for tobacco giant Altria Group that's pushing the bill, said the measure prevents illegal products from overseas popular with youth. China has over 50% of the products that are illegal, Scott recently told the House Ways and Means Subcommittee. 3 out of the 5 youth brands are illicit, but they're still being brought in, he said. Gregory Connolly, director of legislative and external affairs for the American Vapor Manufacturers, said the FDA uses U.S. Customs and Border Patrol to stop illegal products before they enter the U.S. and conduct inspections and issue civil penalties to manufacturers and retailers of illegal products. Quote, the FDA, with their $712 million budget, has decided, oh yeah, we're just going to only target specific products that have youth use problems, he said. That's something you could do in this bill. But just saying all of these products have to be banned? Terrible, terrible policy. There's a reason why Barclays and Goldman Sachs and Altria investors are so interested in this policy. Both Barclays and Goldman Sachs have said that one way for Altria to recover their falling cigarette sales is to put people like Half-Hill and Linden out of business. Conley said the bill imposes a confusing and complicated registration scheme that has been challenged in courts in other states. The FDA in 2016 deemed that e-cigarettes to be tobacco products, like traditional cigarettes, subject to agency review under the Tobacco Control Act, and said manufacturers of the products would need to apply for approval to consider selling them. It initially considered e-cigarettes as having some promise in helping adult smokers transition from conventional cigarettes, but faced pressure from anti-smoking groups to restrict flavored e-cigarettes amid a rise in youth vaping. And we have one obituary today. Violet M. Gouge, age 73 of Garner, died Thursday, March 7th in Mason City. Funeral service, Friday, March 15, 1 p.m. at the Cataldo Funeral Chapel in Garner. Visitation will take place 1 hour before the service. Interment will be held at the Concord Township Cemetery. And that's the halfway point of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, March 12, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. We're so glad to have you listening. And as a reminder, all material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of folks with print disabilities. And you can find this and many of our local programs on demand anytime as podcasts at our website, iowaradioreading.org. Our first story, Still Sky West, Fort Dodge flights to continue, new federal contract approved. And it shows a photo of a United Express flight pulling up to the Fort Dodge Airport. United Express flights operated by SkyWest Airlines will continue serving Fort Dodge Regional Airport for the next 3 years. A newly approved federal essential air service contract is making that possible. That contract goes into effect April 1 and runs through March 31, 2027. We have a final contract with SkyWest in place, said Rhonda Chambers, the airport's director of aviation. I'm just pleased that we're able to continue with the reliable and safe service we have with SkyWest. It's good for the community, and it's good for the airline to have the 3-year contract in place, she added. Passengers, she said, won't notice anything different when the new contract begins. There will still be the same number of flights to Chicago O'Hare International Airport, with seamless connections to United Airlines flights to other cities across the country and the world. The local flights will continue to use 50 passenger jets. The continuity of the service will stay the same, Chambers said. SkyWest United Express began serving Fort Dodge with the aid of an essential air service contract on March 1, 2021. The Essential Air Service Program provides subsidies to ensure that airlines continue to serve small communities. SkyWest will get about $6.4 million a year under the new contract for its Fort Dodge service. Chambers said one other airline did place a bid for serving Fort Dodge with an Essential Air Service contract. She said Southern Airways proposed to use 9-seat single-engine planes. Officials at the U.S. Department of Transportation opted to give the new contract to SkyWest. Up next, paving contract awarded. 8 streets to be repaved in Fort Dodge. Portions of 8 Fort Dodge roads, including a long stretch of North 22nd Street, will be repaved this year. The City Council on Monday hired Fort Dodge Asphalt Company to do the work at a cost of $975,625.10. Fort Dodge Asphalt Company was the only bidder for the project. Here are the streets that will be repaved. 6th Avenue North between 8th and 9th Streets, 7th Avenue North between 7th and 8th Streets, 8th Avenue North between 8th and 9th Streets, North 8th Street between Dakota and 8th Avenue North, North 22nd Street between Timber Lane and North 25th Street, A Street West between Avenue N West and Triton Circle, Patterson Field Road between South 22nd Street and 18th Avenue South, South 17th Street, north of 18th Avenue South. The work will be done this summer and fall. Councilwomen Jen Crimmins and Megan Secor were absent from the otherwise unanimous vote to award the contract. Some more work-related news. 5th Avenue South work ready to go. Traveling down 5th Avenue South may become a smoother and more efficient trip as a result of two contracts awarded by the Fort Dodge City Council on Monday. These contracts will result in concrete patching and upgrades to the traffic signal. Castor Construction of Fort Dodge was hired to do the concrete patch repairs at a cost of $563,206. The work will be done on 5th Avenue South between 15th and 31st Streets. Concrete work will also be done on 15th Street between 6th Avenue North and Floral Avenue. Other bidders for the work include TK Concrete of Pella for $687,564, Jensen Builders Limited of Fort Dodge for $697,880, and Wicks Construction of Decorah for $783,289.80. K&W Electric of Emmitsburg was hired to work on the traffic signals on 5th Avenue South between 25th and 42nd Streets at a cost of $665,765.92. That company will replace video detection systems that use cameras to identify the presence of vehicles and change the lights to meet the needs of traffic. Some of those systems have failed, prompting the traffic's lights to default into a timed phasing, causing unneeded congestion, said Chad Schaefer, the city's chief development officer, in a report to the council. The electrical contractor will also add pedestrian signals to direct people crossing the street, add battery backups, and install flashing yellow arrow signals for left turns. K&W Electric was the only bidder for that work. Also on Monday, the council hired Weikert Contracting, Inc. of Cedar Falls to paint lines on streets at a cost of $62,807.09. Iowa Plains Signing, Inc. of Slater submitted the only other bid of $80,707.20. All of the work approved Monday by the City Council will be done this summer and fall. Councilwoman Jen Crimmins and Megan Secor absent from the otherwise unanimous votes to award these contracts. Wastewater plant plans get second look in Webster City. Herrenstein says prudent alternatives to present plans should be considered. Dateline Webster City. An important topic of discussion at last week's Webster City Council budget work session was the city's new wastewater treatment plant and specifically how to pay for it. The proposed new plant, designed by the city's consultant Bolton and Mank of Ames, is estimated to cost $78,426,000. Interim City Manager John Herrenstein, who has been reviewing the plans and cost estimates, told the council during the meeting last week that he believed, quote, prudent alternatives to the proposed design exist and could result in important cost savings. He suggested that city staff review these potential savings and report back to the council before the plant's final design is approved sometime this summer. A secondary review of Bolton and Mank's design and cost, published last summer by Snyder and Associates of Ankeny, who the city retains as general civil engineering consultants, contain hints as to where these cost savings might come from. It concluded as much as $6.6 million might be saved if certain design modifications are adopted. More savings might be available if the city chooses to make further upgrades to the current wastewater plant or to build the new plant in phases. The plant's operating system will be some variation of activated sludge technology, the most widely used method of treating wastewater in the world. Plants of this type have been in use for more than 100 years. Two particular variations of activated sludge seem to be the finalists for Webster City's plant: the University of Cape Town UCT process and the Sequencing Batch Reactor, or SBR, process. Of the two, the SBR plant should cost less to build. The Snyder and Associates report listed 10 Iowa cities using SBR technology for either municipal or industrial wastewater treatment. They are Marshalltown, North Liberty, Mount Pleasant, Clear Lake, Washington, Atlantic, Old Wine, Eldridge, Clarinda, and Oakland. The Snyder Report continued, quote, "It is certain several cost-saving ideas may be available, but not all may be practical for one reason or another. The treatment system recommended in the facility plan is certainly capable of meeting current DNR requirements. Changes to the plan to reduce cost will require difficult decisions. Those decisions could include modifications ranging from constructing all or part of the proposed improvements on the existing WWTP site, author's note, on East Ohio Street near the leaf and brush dump site, modifying the city's growth projections, which would change the anticipated flows and loads, considering another type of treatment process, and or changing the approach to biosolids management," unquote. Decisions affecting large capital projects like this are said to have 50-year consequences. Indeed, the present wastewater treatment plant, built in 1939 and expanded and upgraded five times since, has been in service 85 years. In periods of wet weather, the plant has operated beyond its rated capacity, a situation that could, in the future, lead to a major spill of wastewater into the Boone River, and a key reason for replacing it. Two key determinants in the plant's ultimate size and capability are population growth and demand for wastewater service by present-day and future industries. When population projections were prepared for the city in 2016, there was a strong possibility the Prestige Pork Processing Plant would be built near Webster City. Taking this into consideration, the population growth model used projected the city's population would reach 11,609 by 2040. That's an annual growth rate of 2.4%. History has shown the reality is dramatically different. Prestige selected a site south of Eagle Grove. Webster City's actual population in 2015 was 7,825. At present growth rates, the city will have only 7,869 residents in 2040. That's a growth rate of only 0.56% per year. In theory, this means a smaller, less costly plant is now a viable option. Another opportunity for reducing the facility's initial cost is to build it in phases, with options for expansion due to unexpected population growth or industrial demand. A key feature of the Bolton and Mank $78 million plan is two 18-inch force mains. Those are pipelines with powerful pumps to move wastewater from the present plant site to the proposed new plant site in the industrial park. Snyder concluded, building one force main now, with provisions for a second later if required, would save a substantial sum of money. It cited successful phased construction of a wastewater plant in Coralville, one of Iowa's fastest growing cities, as an approach that Webster City should consider. The plant design and size ultimately selected must meet the DNR's guidelines for phosphorus and nitrogen removal. Work by Iowa State University, the DNR, and the Iowa Department of Agriculture in 2012 established these standards, today known as the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy. It's Iowa's contribution to reducing growth of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, caused by runoff of phosphorus and nitrogen. Those are the nutrients from farm fields, lawns, and sewage and wastewater treatment plants in states bordering the Mississippi River. And now we'll turn to obituaries. Shirley Ahrens passed away March 10th. Per her wishes, she will be cremated with no services. Inurnment will take place at the Memorial Park Cemetery. Priscilla Pat Wishar, funeral mass Thursday, March 14th, the Resurrection Church in Pocahontas, 10:30 a.m. Burial will take place at the Calvary Cemetery. Visitation 1 hour prior to mass at 10:30. Deborah S. Bites, Deb, age 62, of Fort Dodge, died Sunday, March 10th at her home. To honor her wishes, she will be cremated and there will be no funeral or services. Jenna Coppinger, age 32, of Ames, passed away Sunday, March 10. Services are with the Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Brett Newland passed away January 19 in Iowa. Born February 15, 1971. Celebration of life will be held at the Minnesota Valley Church in Lakeville, Minnesota, March 16, 1 p.m. Visitation will take place 1 hour prior. A luncheon will be served following the service. And then an Iowa celebration of life and luncheon will be held April 6th at the Community Center in Rolfe at 1 p.m. Trent H. Brown, age 13, of Gowrie, died March 6th. Private family services will be held at a later date. You can view the obituary at the website brucesfuneralhome.com. James Wagner passed away Thursday, March 7th at the Van Diest Medical Center in Webster City. Private family graveside services will be held at a later date. Marjorie Harrington, age 90, of Otho, passed away March 2nd at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Visitation will be 10 a.m. Friday at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel, with a service to follow at 11 a.m. Interment will be held at the Otho Cemetery. And turning to opinions, this is an editorial. Nestle Purina Pet Care provides boost to new child care facility. Company has long track record of supporting the community. Getting good child care has been notoriously difficult in Fort Dodge for years. Simply put, the number of kids in need of child care far exceeds the number of available spots in local child care centers. An organization called Linking Families and Communities has worked diligently to bring more child care options into the community. At the beginning of this year, it made a major step toward doing so by buying a building that will be turned into the Sprouts Early Education and Development School. Property is located at 407 Kenyon Road. A lot of people likely remember it as one of the Becker Florist locations. Now that it has the building, Linking Families and Communities can start turning it into the facility the community needs. But doing so will not be cheap. Nestle Purina Pet Care has stepped up to help. The company has donated $25,000 to Linking Families and Communities to assist with the project. That is a big boost for the effort. It's hardly the first time the company has made a significant donation to the important causes or needs in our community. Since 2017, Nestle Purina Pet Care has contributed to the renovation of the emergency room at Unity Point Health, Trinity Regional Medical Center, the acquisition of police canine Draco, the effort to build a new linear accelerator for Trinity Cancer Center, and the purchase of a van for the Almost Home Humane Society of North Central Iowa. Along the way, it's made a generous donation to the Fort Dodge Community Foundation's COVID-19 Disaster Fund. And those are just the big recent donations. Nestle Purina Pet Care has long been a mainstay in the local economy. The company and its employees have been involved in lots of initiatives to support the community. We're pleased and thankful to have such a community-minded corporation here. We're also happy to see linking families and communities making real progress to bring more child care to Fort Dodge. And that was an editorial. And here's a letter to the editor submitted by Andy Fritz. And Andy writes, "Why not vote on everything?" To the editor, with the latest submission of a petition forcing the, quote, case for 8 franchise fee ordinance to a special election, I question why does the city of Fort Dodge have a city manager, mayor, city council, and city department heads? It seems to me the spirit of a representative form of government is dead in this town. It's obvious to me that all citizens of Fort Dodge are fully educated, nuanced, and aware of the workings of city government, especially when it comes to funding sources for public safety and infrastructure. I propose the city eliminate all facets of city government and let the citizens, who obviously know better than the professionals doing their job and the elected officials who represent them, vote on everything. Let us run our city. We will show you how it's done. Make Fort Dodge great again. And that letter sent in from Andy Fritz, former city councilman of Fort Dodge. Next letter to the editor comes from Cheryl O'Hearn of Fort Dodge. Cheryl writes to the editor, "Scams are rampant today, from emails to your website contact information to social media reviews and threats that your account will be deleted unless you click here. Our spin market team receives questions from clients daily about these scams and how to stop them. Unfortunately, there's no easy answer or way to stop them. Currently, Iowa officials and the AARP are kicking off a campaign to stop the spread of imposter scams. The statewide Stop the Scammers campaign is aimed to protect older Iowans, but the tips offered to avoid scams apply to everyone. Addressing social media scammers requires a combination of caution, skepticism, and proactive measures to safeguard your personal information and accounts. Here's how you can protect yourself and communicate effectively to avoid being hacked. Number 1, recognize the signs. Be wary of unsolicited messages or friend requests from unknown individuals, especially if they claim to represent a company or organization. Look out for spelling and grammar errors, unusual requests, or offers that seem too good to be true. Number 2, verify identities. Before engaging with anyone online, verify their identity through official channels if possible. For example, if someone claims to be from a company, contact the company directly through their official website or a customer service line to confirm the legitimacy of the communication. Number 3, protect personal information. Avoid sharing sensitive personal information such as your address, phone number, social security number, or financial details with unknown individuals or entities online. Number 4, enable your security features. Take advantage of security features offered by social media platforms, such as two-factor authentication, which adds an extra layer of protection to your accounts. Regularly review your privacy settings to ensure that your information is only visible to the people that you trust. Number 5, educate yourself. Stay informed about common social media scams and tactics used by scammers to target individuals. Familiarize yourself with the latest trends and be skeptical of any messages or requests that seem suspicious. In conclusion, as the prevalence of scams continues to rise, it's imperative for individuals to remain vigilant and proactive in safeguarding their personal information online. By recognizing the signs, verifying identities, and protecting personal information, enabling security features, and educating ourselves about common tactics used by scammers, we can collectively combat the spread of social media scams. Let's take the necessary steps to protect ourselves and our communities from falling victim to these malicious schemes. And that's from Cheryl O'Hearn of Fort Dodge. And that's all the time we have to read the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, March 12, 2024. You've been listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of folks with print disabilities. I've been your reader, Mary Frances. Have a great day.